Arizona hospitals are treating fewer patients who don't have insurance, but they're also making less money. So what's the deal?
Our uncompensated care is down $200 million, like a third reduction. But even with that, we're seeing hospitals starting to really bleed financially.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, the state legislature approaches adjournment. Federal fire officials are looking into changes to fire shelters. Researchers say there could soon be an app to help detect Alzheimer's disease. And our road trip up Central Avenue continues as we stop downtown.
This area now is a city again. And I wish I had done then and now photography to show how much this area has changed.
Plus, a Phoenix-based label hits a milestone and, chocolate. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Checking traffic across the valley right now, the 101 westbound, that's in the North Valley. It's closed at 51st Avenue because of a rescue and recovery work in progress. Again, the 101 westbound closed at 51st Avenue. Elsewhere, I-10 westbound, an accident at 19th Avenue, and the 60 eastbound has a disabled vehicle at Higley. Sunny skies for the next several days. Look for a high today of 87, 88 tomorrow, 91 on Saturday. Right now, it's partly sunny, 84 degrees at KJZZ. As California implements mandatory water restrictions to deal with historic drought conditions, officials in Arizona say that's not likely to happen in the valley anytime soon. KJZZ's Kerry Young reports.
Water managers in Arizona say there are several factors behind the strength of the state's water portfolio. David Modier is with Central Arizona Project, an organization that provides water to urban areas in central Arizona. He says California's water supply is subjected to more restrictions under the Endangered Species Act, limiting the amount of water that can be diverted for human use. He says Arizona's water storage efforts have also helped to make our supply less dynamic each year.
The storage in Lake Mead and Lake Powell and our underground storage that we've created in Arizona puts us in a very different situation than California. The Northern California water supply is really dependent upon annual snowpack.
According to Modier, more than 8 million acre-feet of water is stored underground in Arizona. He estimates that could last the state more than 20 years. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Gas prices around Arizona are slightly lower again this week. AAA Arizona says the average statewide price for a gallon of regular unleaded is $2.35 a gallon. That's a drop of almost 3 cents from last week. Then this week's national average is $2.40 a gallon, down by more than 2 cents from last week. Tucson has Arizona's lowest average gas price, Flagstaff the highest. State lawmakers appear to be inching toward adjournment, possibly either tonight or maybe in the wee hours of Friday morning. Joining me to discuss what's left to do is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Hi, Howie.
Well, it's more than inching. I think they're actually hurtling toward a finish. You know, the Senate today has already done several dozen bills, some which were sent to the governor, some sent back to the House. And they seem to be in a rush to get out of here before Good Friday.
Does the House appear to be playing along?
Well, the House has always operated on its own sort of bizarre time zone. Sort of, they were supposed to come in, for example, at 10 o'clock. Well, they finally got to the floor a lot later than that. And the other problem, of course, in the House is with 60 members and more people who want to talk on everything, that could hold up the process. I mean, we had a bill just the other day on ballot harvesting, and that one bill took over an hour. And when you consider we have several dozen still to act on, anything's possible here.
What are some of the notable bills that lawmakers still have to take up before they can go home?
Well, there's things that are sort of simmering below the surface. You know, will they, for example, prohibit cities from allowing pawnbrokers to charge fees? We still may even have that flex loan bill out there. Again, nothing stays dead until they actually go home. Will they allow the governor to create an inspector general with a badge and maybe even a gun to go out and subpoena things and find out what's going on? Will we ask voters to go ahead and create a lieutenant governor position? So there's a lot of major things. And then, of course, it's always these tiny little issues that somebody gets upset about. You know, we had a vote this morning on whether spayed and neutered cats can be released from the pound before 72 hours. And that's the kind of stuff that gets people upset.
What seems to be the rush to leave so soon, to adjourn so soon? This would be the earliest adjournment in many, many years.
Well, part of it is because the budget is out of the way. As you well know, there are many years the budget's the last thing done. With that out of the way, they could go back and concentrate on policy and do a few technical fixes to the budget. I think the belief is the longer folks hang around, the more mischief can be done. You know, you have lawmakers sitting around each saying, you know, I just thought of a brilliant idea, which should send a chill through up the spines of every one of our listeners.
Is there a sense that by adjourning this early that they're increasing the chance of lawmakers having to be called back into a special session later in the year to either take up something they didn't take up or fix something that was passed during the session?
Well, at this point, I don't see any obvious fixes. Again, it depends on what winds up left on the table. The governor wants, for example, to abolish the Department of Weights and Measures. There are a lot of folks who are saying, wait a second, you just pulled this out of somewhere at the last minute, and we really haven't had a chance to look at that. So maybe if it's really important, we can come back. I don't think there's any particular desire to come back in a special session. I think that there's a lot of raw feelings between Republicans and Democrats over some of the election laws. There's a lot of hurt feelings even among Republicans who wanted to abolish Common Core versus their colleagues who said, why would we want to blow up the system? And I don't think there's a particular desire to come back. However, I wouldn't be willing to lay a lot of money on that.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, hope you have some coffee ready for tonight. Looks like it's going to be another late night at the Capitol. Thank you, as always.
You're very welcome.
According to a new report, Arizona hospitals have been operating at smaller margins over the past few years, despite more Arizonans having health insurance under the state's Medicaid program. Greg Vigdor is president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association, which released the financial report.
What we know is that our uncompensated care is down $200 million, like a third reduction. But even with that, we're seeing hospitals starting to really bleed financially. The overall operating margins for the state are 2%, and about 30% of our members are actually losing money.
Why is that?
Well, it's what we said at the time of Medicaid restoration when people were saying this is going to be some type of a windfall for the hospitals. We were pointing out that the Medicaid agency access here pays 70 cents on the dollar for the cost of care. And so having more of those patients isn't going to make you a lot of money. So we were trying to get some rate increases around that, and then we were unsuccessful a couple of years ago. And what's worse now is we're now going to see up to a 5% reduction in payment rates because of the action by the state legislature.
So do you expect those operating margins to get even lower going forward?
Yes, absolutely. First, because of that, and remember, we're facing a couple of other pretty big threats to our world, one of which is the lawsuit to the Medicaid restoration, which if that went through would somehow interfere with, in fact, the drop in uncompensated care costs. And we also have the U.S. Supreme Court consideration, the King versus Burwell case about the future of federal exchanges, of which we have one in Arizona. Those two things happening in addition would really, I think, cause some great distress across the hospital and healthcare community across the state.
It looks like one of the other things that you found was that the number of emergency department visits went up pretty considerably between 2013 and 2014. And I'm curious about that because one of the arguments that proponents of Medicaid expansion made was that having folks who had some kind of insurance, be it Medicaid or something else, would mean that they wouldn't have to go to the ER every time they got sick. They'd be able to actually go see a physician. It doesn't seem as though that's necessarily happening all the time, though.
Right. And that is one of the arguments. I think it still is a strong argument for it. We're trying to understand that a little bit better and a couple of things that are relevant to that. I think one is it's exactly what I was saying about the provider payment rates, and this is more to the point around the primary care side of this. If physicians aren't getting paid enough, they're going to be much more less likely to take Medicaid patients, access patients, and so we might be seeing a reflection of the primary care side of the equation sort of breaking down a bit and having more people show up at emergency rooms rather than going where they'd prefer they go. I think there's also just a question about whether we're seeing some different care needs. Is it a bigger flu season? Things have seemed a bit more busy in the hospitals generally, and it might be a reflection just of it's a different disease world, for lack of a better term, going on this year than other years. But I think that is a little bit troubling to us, and we want to understand it better ourselves.
Have you heard of physicians who have decided that they're just not going to take Medicaid patients anymore or are thinking about dropping those patients?
Well, I've definitely heard the threat. come across in a number of meetings. And I'm hearing, again, in my world, I'm hearing more conversation among the hospitals, nothing that they want to take publicly, about whether they can continue some of their less profitable services, that it just might be reaching a breaking point where they're going to have to make some of those hard decisions as well. So I think the provider community is I think, in a state of unrest about what's going on in the state capitol. And I think most of all, it's the sense of that the way to make the state budget work is just to always cut provider rates. What we found is that in just the hospital world, since 2008, we have seen cumulative rate reductions and rate increases that we should have gotten that have been foregone. And that's now totaling over $1 billion annualized impact year by year. And that's just too much. You just can't tolerate that. And at some point, you just have to say enough. And I think that's what we're starting to hear more of, and we'll see how it all plays out.
Greg Vigdor is president and CEO of the Arizona Hospital and Healthcare Association. Greg, thanks so much.
Happy to do it. Good talking with you.
The U.S. Forest Service is looking at potentially making changes to the design of its fire shelters. Those are the devices firefighters use as a last resort when they're trapped by a fire. Those changes could include making the shelters out of a different material. Tony Petrilli is the project leader for the Fire Shelter Project Review.
Not many companies or high-temperature fabric producers know anything about fire shelters, so I have to make it, look at these materials, evaluate them, and see if they have any potential to be used in a fire shelter. Many high-temperature materials are either heavy, relatively heavy, bulky, or fragile, or toxic, or something like that. But we're trying to evaluate materials for potential use in fire shelters, and we have a test protocol with a battery of tests that any material with potential, we send through that test battery.
Is this an acknowledgement that the current fire shelters aren't good enough, or is this just sort of a way to look, hey, can we make these better?
The project review was scheduled to start in 2015, and that was, just on a life cycle plan, and it got moved up to start in 2014, and we're evaluating other potential materials that could be used in the fire shelter. But, if there's nothing suitable that, increases performance without, other downfalls in it, then we will stick with the current model.
Did the project get moved up because of Yarnell Hill, or were there other factors involved in that?
I think definitely the biggest factor in moving the project review up 1 year was the Yarnell Hill fire.
What kind of attributes does a material have to have? I mean, obviously it's got to be able to withstand high temperatures, but what else are you looking for before you say, yes, this is a material that we could use in our fire shelters?
It's pretty complicated. We've got, I guess, the search for materials is broken down into three different categories, if you will. One is a marked improvement in performance in materials, and that will most likely come at an increase in weight and bulk. We also have another category of the same weight and bulk of the current shelter and see if we can improve the performance in that category. And we're also looking at lighter weight materials and see what kind of performance that we can get from lighter weight materials.
Is it conceivable that you or someone else would be able to conceive of a new material, a new textile that maybe hasn't been made before that could serve this purpose?
Actually, yes. We have a working agreement with the Langley Research Center of NASA. They, too, have it's actually a similar project in that they have, in the space shuttle, they have ceramic tiles attached to the bottom of the space shuttle for reentry. In other space vehicles, that they're looking at a flexible, deployable shield for the same purpose. So they're looking at fabrics and materials and trying to basically create new materials. It's you know, in the development stages of that technology, but we'll see where that goes.
Tony Petrilli is the project leader for the Fire Shelter Project Review with the U.S. Forest Service. The testing is happening this year. He expects to lay out potential options next year. If fire managers decided to go with a new fire shelter, it'll take about a year to design and produce them and get them to firefighters. Still to come, a Valley-based record label has a platinum album 25 years after its release.
For an independent to have achieved that with an artist playing a Native American flute makes it a very rare event.
That's ahead. It's the show. On the Valley Freeways, 101 westbound is closed at 51st Avenue due to a rescue and recovery work that's going on there. Definitely avoid the area of the 101 westbound at 51st Avenue. Sunny skies for the rest of the day into tomorrow as well. A high today of 87, 88 tomorrow. It's 84 degrees at KJZZ at 220.
KJZZ is supported by the Musical Instrument Museum, celebrating Middle Eastern music with live musical performances, hands-on activities, dancing, and more. Saturday and Sunday, April 11th and 12th. More at mim.org.
Neighborhoods really are the core of our city.
And when people come here, they see a stark difference from what they remember from decades ago.
The idea is that we are a melting pot of people who want urban living.
This neighborhood literally was born probably, I'd say, in a period of 5 years.
It's an iconic road that splits the city between streets and avenues. When you travel its length, you can see Phoenix's past and future, and you can see distinct neighborhoods that have grown along with the city, which is why we're driving along Central Avenue from South Mountain to North Mountain in a new series called Central, exploring the people and places that define the avenue. Last week, we went from South Mountain to the Salt River. Today, we continue north from the river to McDowell. I'm in downtown on the corner of Central and Washington, and in a sense, this is where it all starts in Phoenix, at least address-wise.
For years, we used to tell all these people from out of town, like, just go to Google Earth and type Phoenix, Arizona in there, nothing else, and see where the pin drops. And the pin would dead-end right into Central and Washington, and there was nothing there.
Jeff Malosnick is Vice President of Development for Red Development, the company behind Cityscape. It's a mixed-use development which takes up a couple of city blocks between First Avenue and First Street and Washington and Jefferson. The first phase of Cityscape opened in 2010, around the same time light rail started running, ASU began offering classes at its downtown campus, and the Phoenix Convention Center was undergoing its expansion. Malosnick calls the changes downtown over that time almost revolutionary.
This neighborhood literally was born probably, I'd say, in a period of 5 years, and now it's all figuring out how to coexist.
Less than a mile north of Malosnick's office, just a few light rail stops away, is another Phoenix neighborhood that's enjoyed a revival.
The great thing about Roosevelt is it's truly built from within, and then that energy then ripples in a really unique way throughout the rest of the city.
That's consultant and entrepreneur Shannon Scutari. She specializes in transit-oriented community development. She says Roosevelt Row's growth comes from lots of people who have made a commitment to the area in order to create what they couldn't find in other parts of Phoenix. The neighborhood's popularity, though, has caused some tension. Earlier this year, protesters held a mock funeral for Roosevelt Row. They were concerned that plans to tear down a few buildings in the neighborhood would cause it to lose some of its character. Scutari says it's important to think of investments and developments as more than just financial arrangements.
If the only metric is financial gain, then we will lose the commitment to the authenticity of the area. So the money has to really come with the strings that says it's really a long-term commitment for the investor.
Scutari and I spoke upstairs from Songbird Coffee and Tea House on Roosevelt. It's also connected to a gallery and office space. And just nearby is another notable tenant of this neighborhood, ASU Downtown. David Foster is a professor at the school's Tempe campus, but has lived in Phoenix for almost 50 years and wrote a book called Glimpses of Phoenix. He says while some cities and universities have trouble relating to each other, that hasn't been the case here.
The incursion of the university here has meant that the existing residential installations, some of which are very old, have had new tenants. It's meant the building of new residential areas. It's meant an enormous development of commercial establishments. And so there are people who are making a lot of money off of providing services to the university.
Foster says downtown's revival can be attributed, at least in part, to people deciding they wanted to live closer to where they work and hang out, and that coming back to downtown is a way for Phoenicians to enrich their depth of experience of the city.
This area now is a city again, and I wish I had done then and now photography to show how much this area has changed.
Another longtime resident agrees the neighborhood is different than it used to be. Gigi George is president of the Encanto Citizens Association.
Neighborhoods really are the core of our city. So people have come together to basically rescue these older neighborhoods and make them very desirable once again.
George says that really picked up during the Great Recession when some people living in the burbs decided to move back into the city. She describes downtown as an interactive portion of Phoenix. On the southern end of this section of Central, people are still working on developing that interactivity. One of them is Steve Rosenstein. Along with his wife, he owns and operates The Deuce.
Most of the people that I knew up in Scottsdale said, you're out of your mind for going down there and trying to do something like this.
The Deuce is another multi-use space, part bar, part game room, and parts of a few other things. It's been open for 5 years. Rosenstein says when he and his wife bought the building, it needed a lot of love. He says downtown was already in the midst of its revitalization, but south of downtown, in the less dense warehouse district where the Deuce is, it was still quiet. Rosenstein, though, predicts that'll change.
It's really going to be, you know, the right developers coming down here and doing the right kind of residential. The companies are going to find it because, you know, vintage warehouses are really what people want right now. So, and there's not a lot of them left, and whatever's left is right here in the warehouse district.
To Rosenstein, the right kind of residential is a combination of lofts and old warehouses like his, but also new mid and high-rise buildings, as well as townhouses. Jeff Malosnick of Red Development says having a bunch of different types of places to live will only help Phoenix. He and Shannon Scutari both understand why this area may occasionally experience some growing pains. Scutari points out Phoenicians have had to discover what an urban experience really is, even though the city may have been somewhat urban years ago.
But we've gotten so far away from all of that over the last 50, 60 years that the generation of people working on these things right now have to really create what urban communities or not even necessarily urban, but what more connected communities look like.
And even though the neighborhoods in this section of Central have become more connected, there are still some connections to Phoenix's past here, including the Westward Ho, Shackelford House, and Irish Cultural Center. Our trip up Central continues tomorrow when we visit the section between McDowell and Bethany Home. In the meantime, there's a whole lot more to check out online. You can hear more from some of the people who live and work along Central, see photos from the entire stretch of the road, check out maps of the neighborhoods, and much more. It's all at kjzzcentral.tumblr.com. You know the phrase, good things come to those who wait? That has turned out to be the case for Robert Doyle. He's president of Canyon Records, a Phoenix-based independent label. In 1989, the flautist R. Carlos Nakai released his album Canyon Trilogy, and recently that album was certified platinum, the label's first platinum album.
It took us 25 years to do it, but we did get the platinum record.
Well, what took so long? I mean, is that common?
Well, I think that we have to consider where it's coming from. That is, it's an independent company, a small independent company in the great world of the music industry. So for an independent to have achieved that with an artist playing a Native American flute makes it a very rare event. And I think even though we can look at 25 years as taking a long time, it's really a testimony to how steadily the album has sold for a quarter century.
In some ways, is that actually almost better for you and for R. Carlos Nakai that the music has sort of stayed popular or some level of popularity over two decades as opposed to being really, really popular and then sort of falling off the table?
Oh, I definitely agree with that statement. Number one, it kept us from all going insane, buying boats and airplanes and so forth, so we had a much steadier cash flow. But it really indicates the longevity, the sustained interest in it from people. It does indicate that it was being marketed by a small company without budgets to blast it around the country and the world. And so we had to really work on a grassroots basis. And our Carlos Nakai also had to continue to work and get his music out there and find new fans and new buyers.
So how many albums is a platinum album?
A platinum album is 1 million sold.
Do you have a sense of whether folks are actually buying CDs, if they're downloading the album, buying it from iTunes, things like that?
Primary sales are still compact discs. We built a fairly diverse distribution structure back in the 90s, and then even when the mainstream store system collapsed beginning in 2007, we were able to sell CDs through our alternative distribution. We do see, of course, sales through iTunes and Amazon downloads, but compact disc is still the predominant way it's selling.
What does this mean for Canyon Records, that you guys have a platinum album you can hang on the wall?
Well, it means, firstly, it's a testimony to our longevity, that we just keep hanging around. And when the music industry began its turmoil about 2007, we stayed the course. But it's a very, very rare achievement, if I can use that many varies in front of rare, for any independent label. We don't have the marketing structure. We don't have the reps. We don't have the worldwide contacts that the major labels do. But I've used this analogy in talking about it. A lot of people earn platinums and the big labels, but it's like climbing Mount Everest with a full team of support. A lot of oxygen tanks, a lot of Sherpas helping you climb that mountain. For R. Carlos Nakai, in a way, he climbed Everest by himself, let's just say a couple Sherpas helping him get up there without oxygen. It's that kind of achievement.
So given that you don't have the budget and the staff to do a ton of marketing, do you plan to use this achievement in future marketing?
Well, to capitalize on this achievement, we created a special platinum edition version of Canyon Trilogy in which we added 5 tracks that had never been released. So the album went from a 60-minute album to a 75-minute album with no increase of price. So we're giving our future fans a bit of a bonus. And since people use this music a lot for meditation, yoga, healing therapies, we've had people use it for birthing, for dealing with grief, maybe that extra 15 minutes is going to be of value to them.
So do you actually get a platinum record to hang on your wall at the studio?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Is it out there now?
We have one in the lobby, of course. And then on March 25th, we did a platinum celebration concert at the MIM, where RC presented his platinum record to be placed in his artist gallery at the MIM.
Robert Doyle is president of Canyon Records here in Phoenix. Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, I'm Joe Sirota, Sirota Candy Company, Glendale, Arizona. It started in 1933. I'm third generation. Pop is still here. He's 86 years old, his second generation. And we have some of our children here as well. My mother used that very press in 1933. She did it by hand. We put a motor on it.
I can introduce you to this machine. Her name is Clarice. She's very finicky. Nobody can run her but me.
Easter is probably the most chocolate used because of the solid bunnies. The number one selling is probably the Arizona Jackrabbit. The kids love that because there's a lot of ears to eat.
That was Joe Sirota and Darla Solly making Easter candy at Sirota Candy Company. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we're sweet, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. And a reminder to check out our Tumblr page for the Central Avenue series. It's called, very simply, Central. Lots of photos, some more audio. You can hear the stories that have aired so far. It's all at kjzzcentral.tumblr.com.
KJZZ is supported by St. Mary's Food Bank Alliance. You can support St. Mary's Food Bank during Arizona Gives Day on April 7th. More at stmarysfoodbank.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Obama is praising what he calls the historic understanding worked out between Iran and the U.S. and other major world powers on curbing Iran's nuclear program. The framework agreement was reached after intensive negotiations in Switzerland. NPR's Peter Kenyon is there and says the deal is more specific than many had expected.
Iran will be forced to cut its 98% of its stockpile of enriched nuclear fuel. It's going to have to cut 2/3 of its installed centrifuges for at least 10 years. Other provisions are going to last for 15 years, and some will even last for 25.
That's NPR's Peter Kenyon. The details of a comprehensive accord are to be worked out over the next 3 months, but the president cautions that a final deal is not guaranteed. At least 147 people have been killed in an attack on a university campus in Kenya by Islamist militants from the group Al-Shabaab. NPR's Gregory Warner reports it was the deadliest attack on Kenyan soil since the bombing of the U.S. embassy there in 1998.
The gunmen had chosen a block of university dorm rooms ideal for a standoff, with a clear line of sight in all directions. The four gunmen were from Al-Shabaab, the Islamist group based over the border in Somalia, the same group that claimed responsibility for the attack in 2013 on Westgate Mall in Nairobi. That attack was also designed to trap civilians inside a building and extend a siege for maximum media attention. The attack, which began at dawn, did not end until after nightfall, when security personnel fired on the gunmen, detonating their explosive vests. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.
A choir singing in Rome's main prison today as Pope Francis washed the feet of inmates as part of a mass for Maundy Thursday, the day the Christians mark the night of the Last Supper. The Bible says Jesus washed the feet of his disciples to give them an example of service. This is NPR News.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. Let's take a deeper look at what's being described as a misunderstanding that's behind the rather unpleasant PR, boycotts, and condemnations unfolding now in Indiana and Arkansas. The bills behind all of this are similar to one vetoed last year by then-Arizona Governor Jan Brewer after lawmakers passed it through both houses. The Religious Freedom Restoration Acts in both Indiana and Arkansas seem to give business owners some opt-out provision of anti-discrimination laws if they would have to violate some deeply held religious belief.
A spiritual belief that the Supreme Court has held that people cannot be compelled to violate by the state under the famous Hobby Lobby case from last year. Ellie Misdahl is an editor at the journal Above the Law. He says Hobby Lobby was actually an invitation for politicians to create just this kind of controversy.
I'm really surprised that people are so angry in Indiana because the Supreme Court did all of their discriminatory work for them last year during the Hobby Lobby decision. The key to that decision, Justice Alito expanded the meaning of persons, which previously had meant actual people or nonprofit corporations, and they expanded that meaning to for-profit corporations. So under Hobby Lobby, any corporation can claim a religious exemption to discrimination laws, basically, based on Alito's reasoning. Now, this is an important distinction. If you think about it, nobody really has a problem if the Catholic Church says, I'm not going to give you bread because you are gay. That's not great. That's not something that I would support, but it's the Catholic Church. You're going to let them do what they do. If the soup Nazi says, no soup for you because you're gay, that's a completely different level of discrimination, and that's the level of discrimination that Hobby Lobby opened up.
But how is it the same that someone who, say, sells flowers in Indiana, who isn't paying anything, is actually getting money to serve a client who is involved in a same-sex marriage ceremony? How is that the same? How does that become an equivalent sort of restriction of religion?
The best way of putting it is that before the Indiana law, before Hobby Lobby, before all of this went down, if I wanted something, if I was gay and I wanted something and you denied me that service, that thing that is open to the rest of the public because I was gay, then I have a discrimination suit against you. And the lawsuit then becomes, did you or did you not discriminate against me because I was gay? Maybe you discriminated against me because you don't like me. That's fine, actually. If you discriminate against me because of my class status, then you lose that lawsuit. In Indiana now, under the RFRA, the alleged discriminator has a defense to say that, yes, I discriminated against you, but I discriminated against you because I have a deeply held religious belief. And my deeply held religious belief allows me to supersede your rights as a person to discriminate against you in this particular way.
But wait, it's more like, because I don't like the gay marriage thing, I can discriminate against you. If I just don't like gays, that's against the law.
That might be a distinction without a difference, honestly. We don't know how these court cases are gonna actually turn. We don't know how these lawsuits are actually gonna come out. One of the weird things about the Indiana law, right, is that they don't actually require you to explain where you've got this deeply held religious belief. Arguably anybody could say it. There's a pizza place in Indiana that says, well, we're not gonna deliver pizzas to gay weddings, as if there's a gay wedding that has pizza delivery. But anyway.
I'm not going there, but whatever.
You know, they could claim arguably anything. And then the way that the law is set up now is that the courts would have to figure out if there was a less discriminatory way for protecting the owner's religious beliefs, right? But that completely shifts the burden of the question from a binary, did you or did you not discriminate against this person, to a much more nebulous, well, yes, you discriminated, but what's your belief? And how deeply held is that belief? And what other ways might you have been able to? It becomes an entire morass of problems. And that's why a lot of the critics have been saying about the Indiana law, the problem is that it opens up the state. It opens up the situation to all kinds of discrimination that we don't know where it's going to come from yet, and we don't know how the courts are going to sort that out.
All right, here's one for you. It is illegal, if I own a retail establishment, to put a sign in my window that says, we do not serve blacks here, correct?
Correct.
Is it illegal for me to put a sign in my window which says, we do not serve individuals who are planning to have same-sex marriages?
I mean, it's really, it's almost a Minority Report pre-COG level.
It's a stumper all of a sudden.
Can you ban somebody for something that they might do? That's unclear. There are legitimate distinctions between, let's say, a public accommodations place. That was the main of the segregation of the civil rights laws, right? So there's a distinction between something that's a public accommodation versus businesses that seem more like speech, right? So if I have a restaurant and I say I'm not going to serve gay people, that's probably still illegal, although in Indiana there will be a court case now probably over that. If I say I'm not going to bake a cake for gay weddings, that's a little bit different because now you're not just dealing with discrimination laws. You're dealing with kind of more seemingly legitimate First Amendment laws because baking the cake requires a creative expression.
If I very compellingly, and I can't do this because I don't believe this, but if I was able to say to you, I can't sleep at night because I sold these lilies to this couple who got married in this way that it just really offends me.
I can't sleep.
Would you say to that?
I would say I can't sleep at night because the Mets signed Michael Kadire as their big free agent signing, right? Like, there are lots of things that make us not be able to sleep. I can go to Shea Stadium and I can boo, all right, but I can't make it legally impossible for Michael Kadire to play.
They come to my shop to buy flowers.
You're selling the flowers.
But Justice Alito.
Justice Alito suggests, Indiana suggests, that you selling them flowers would be an unimaginable impingement on your religious belief. How far are we willing to take that? Because there are lots of things in the Bible. There are lots of things in the Torah. There are lots of things in the Quran that suggest that you should be really angry about that we're not anymore. There are so many anachronistic prohibitions in these ancient texts that the thought of applying those prohibitions under the guise of legal protection so that you can deny somebody else services, it would be an unworkable society if we did that.
Eli Mistal, an editor at Above the Law, editor-at-large of Breaking Media, which publishes Above the Law and is the managing editor of ATL Redline. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, John.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Once a place for spring breakers, Bo Derek and other Hollywood stars, Acapulco's reputation has been hit hard in recent years. The city has Mexico's highest homicide rates, and while drug gangs have contributed to its troubles, the disappearance of 43 students in September in a town just a few hours away has increased tensions. Extortion is a big problem, and teachers have become a particular target for criminal gangs. The BBC's Katie Watson reports.
We've come to a school in a neighborhood that's just a block away from the smartest hotels and restaurants here in Acapulco. And we're outside a school at drop-off time. It's about 7 o'clock in the morning. And as children and parents are arriving, they're being greeted by teachers and ticked off on the register. But there are also three soldiers outside the school, complete with body armor, helmets, and machine guns.
Teachers here went on strike in late November after a spate of murders and kidnappings. They only returned to the classrooms once they were guaranteed protection. Now, around 1,000 soldiers guard schools across the city. Jesús Barrios Mendoza has a granddaughter at the school.
I think there should be more soldiers because of the situation in the schools. There have been teachers kidnapped, and apart from that, it also protects students.
Walter Emmanuel Añorbe Rodriguez is part of the teachers' union in Guerrero.
The brutality of violence is getting worse and worse. As a sector, we are employed, and we have the means to have a modest and a stable quality of life. And so we've been targeted as a group able to pay a ransom.
We head to one of Acapulco's poorer neighborhoods. Violence and insecurity here impacts everyone, not just those involved in criminal gangs. Just over a year ago, a 32-year-old woman was murdered. Her mother told us that she knows who killed her. Despite speaking to police, he still remains free. Her words have been revoiced to protect her identity.
My daughter was screaming. The neighbors realized she was being taken by force. She was strangled with a steel cable, hands tied behind her back, as if she was a criminal. The government doesn't understand. It doesn't understand because it doesn't live with this pain and helplessness.
We're in a police pickup truck traveling along Acapulco's beach road. With officers toting machine guns, it's a reminder for tourists that they're holidaying in a troubled city.
We've been in Acapulco for just over a day, and in that time we've been alerted throughout the day to several murders across the city. We've been brought to a crime scene. It's right in the centre of Acapulco along the promenade, and a man has been shot and killed as he was getting off the bus.
As the body is pulled out of the bus, there's no attempt to shield the public or stop photographers from trampling on the crime scene to get the photo for tomorrow's newspapers. But it's crimes like these that need to be tackled to win back tourists and assure Acapulco's residents of a brighter future.
That's the BBC's Katie Watson in Acapulco. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic. The 101 westbound is closed at 51st Avenue due to rescue and recovery work. You want to avoid that area. 101 westbound at 51st Avenue. Still to come, ASU researchers look at a new way to potentially detect Alzheimer's disease. That's still ahead. It's the show.
KJZZ is supported by the Arizona Center for After School Excellence, providing the Arizona After School Directory, where parents can find enriching summer programs for their children. azafterschool.org. When school's out, make it count.
The so-called McDowell Corridor near the corner of Scottsdale Road and McDowell used to be a vibrant part of South Scottsdale. There was retail nearby at Los Arcos Mall, and auto dealers lined up along what was known as the Motor Mile. Then it's an understatement to say things slowed down a lot. More than a decade ago, there was a push to put an arena there to house the then Phoenix Coyotes, but voters rejected it. Stepping in to fill the void just a few years ago was Skysong, a mixed-use development that includes big and small businesses and apartments. If you've driven in the area, you've definitely noticed Skysong and its unique design, including shade coverings that look like something out of Disneyland, particularly at night. SkySong got off to a slow start, but it's getting credit for helping revive the McDowell Corridor. Chris Crewson is Senior Managing Director at Newmark Grubb Knight Frank, a Phoenix-based property sales and leasing firm.
This is a good example of public and a private sectors getting together and having some success. It's really grown into a huge part of that area, and now we're starting to see a lot of other redevelopment plays off of SkySong and the 41 acres that they have there, meaning you have Mark Taylor next door who is doing multifamily, and as you go down McDowell Road, you're starting to see a lot of other projects going on.
How long can you wait for a project to see if it's going to attract other tenants and other people who are excited about it? Can that make someone in your position or someone who deals with selling the space a little bit nervous, waiting for people to feel like, is there a buzz around this?
Absolutely, and I think there's a couple factors that go into that. I mean, one is the timing of the project when it was first started on the office side with phase one and two wasn't great. They built into the time when we started to have what I'd call the real estate crash, and so the market really shut off from a leasing standpoint for quite some time. You also had the questions out there, what is SkySong? I don't think there wasn't a brand to it, so the marketplace did not exactly know what was going on there. Some people thought it was a campus. Others understood it to be lab space and some other things, but it really what it was a technology hub for companies and also for a place that you had the partnership with the foundation, the developers, in creating what I would call a technology hub and also a mixed-use project. As you look into who was first there, I mean, Ticketmaster was probably the first big tenant to make the jump there to go to SkySong. But yes, you always have that issue with who's going to be first in, what's the project going to look like, what is the project, why should I be here? And especially in a submarket that really wasn't defined at that time. I mean, SkySong is really the only real office, true office development in that area and to that quality and size.
Chris Crewson, Senior Managing Director at Newmark Grubb Knight Frank in Phoenix. With SkySong known as the ASU Scottsdale Innovation Center, a bulk of the project's focus is serving as an economic incubator, moving innovative ideas from the academic realm to market. The concept took hold in Silicon Valley, with startups and corporations working with established colleges and universities, and competition has grown from there. Neelam Sullivan is Technology Development Manager of the California Nanosystems Institute, or CNSI, at UCLA. She says it's vital that the incubator be its own ecosystem of sorts.
Where you have engaged members who are actively looking for opportunities, sharing opportunities, communicating, and there's a two-way flow, I guess, of things coming from us and then things coming back through the community back to us. Silicon Valley in itself is one of the holy grails of an ecosystem that supports itself, is hugely engaged, is working really well, and creates good things. The idea is to create an ecosystem where you are around yourself that replicates that level of energy, or at least that type of dynamic.
Sullivan says that's most likely to happen when the academic and business sides are in sync. Todd Hardy is Vice President of Assets for the ASU Foundation, one of SkySong's partners. He agrees that the public-private partnership is a key to making operations like this work.
We are also looking at places that are older than we are throughout the country to learn from their best practices and advance our strategies here at SkySong as a result of that. So I think the answer is that ASU is the kind of partner that really makes an innovation center like the one we have here at SkySong grow, and we can see that throughout the country and other places.
How important is the incubator to part of this?
I was just at a recent conference in D.C. called Select USA, where Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, said that innovation occurs in very few places throughout the country, but in many places that have a university-led, innovation-based center of activity, including the incubation of new and different businesses. And he was right in saying that, because when a company comes here with two people from elsewhere in the country or from outside the United States, And they need to learn about the ecosystem here. They need to learn about supply chains. They need to learn about the market. The best place to do that is a place where they can come and get services that they need to start and grow their companies and to be around other companies to learn from and partner with and also be able to access workforce that they need to grow their companies.
Going forward with economic development, how patient can people, can communities afford to be? Because everyone sort of wants to see results right away, even if that's not realistic.
It's just a reality that people would like to see results, major results, in the very near term. And we've been able to do that. We've been able, as I said, the economic impact of Skysong already is in the hundreds of millions of dollars. But we all have to be patient with what the ultimate prize really is and can be. We're only third developed here at Skysong. We have a goal of developing 1.2 million square feet of office space here at Skysong. And when that happens and when we bring more and more of the amenities that are now being demanded of these innovation centers all over the country to this particular location and become that vibrant engine for development of the entire McDowell Road corridor, that's the kind of prize that I think everyone should keep in their minds. And that will be the kind of driver of growth, jobs, and economic development for this whole region that everyone envisioned a few years ago.
Todd Hardy is Vice President of Assets for the ASU Foundation, one of the partners at Skysong.
Researchers at ASU are looking at a new way to potentially help diagnose Alzheimer's disease and other neurological ailments. They studied transcripts of news conferences held by former presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and compared their speech patterns over time. Their findings were published in the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Visar Barisha is one of the researchers. He's in the Department of Speech and Hearing Sciences and the School of Electrical, Computer, and Energy Engineering at ASU.
As it turns out, speech and language production provide this excellent window into the brain. So even the simplest verbal response, like the one I'm generating right now, it requires this complex sequence of events. So I first have to think of the words that I want to use, then sequence them correctly based on some rules imposed by the language. And finally, I have to send signals to the muscles that help me produce speech to speak. And so even the slightest damage to any of the brain areas that orchestrate these events can manifest in speech problems. So to that end, one of our interdisciplinary projects is using algorithms to automatically track changes in speech production, speech and language production, as sort of a proxy for a neurological disease progression. And of course, that includes Alzheimer's. Now, this is important because speech can be collected non-invasively with just a microphone. And so in that context, the study that we did with the former presidents was really largely driven by data availability.
Are you able to discern whether or not a pattern of speech or maybe a mistake when somebody speaks is just sort of an instant in time, like they had, for lack of a better word, a brain fart, or if there's maybe something larger going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. The analysis actually looks at trends over extended periods of time. So for President Reagan, for example, this is from 1981 to 1988. So one-off events typically don't influence the analysis a great deal.
So based on this research, what did you determine about President Reagan?
I think the first thing that's important to state is that it's impossible to say from our analysis that the former president was experiencing signs of Alzheimer's at the end of his presidency. I think, indeed, it's very difficult to make that statement from the outside, period. These changes that we observed could be due to other reasons. So there could be some other injury that we don't know about, or perhaps, he found it politically advantageous to change his speaking style. I think what the findings do is they give us a reason to further study these methods as perhaps a foundation for building non-invasive diagnostic tools. So one might imagine one day, in the not-so-distant future, I might add, a mobile application that automatically tracks changes in speech production and provides a notification when it notices something that's uncharacteristic. Or perhaps mobile applications that partially automate speech therapy intervention for individuals with neurological disorders. So I think the finding is more relevant in that sense than it is for making any sort of determination about the former president's cognitive state while in office.
I'm curious if you think that speech could ultimately be something that could be used in a diagnosis or maybe just something of like an early warning system.
Indeed, as it stands now, there's a great deal of evidence to suggest that speech changes themselves can be used as an early warning system for some of these neurological disorders. Some of the studies that we've done and others have done show that there's changes in speech production for Parkinson's or for ALS, for example, that correlate with the progression of the disease. And because of the very precise movement of the articulators required to produce speech, it's often a leading indicator in these disorders. So I think as it stands now, I can certainly see a situation where you can use speech as an early indicator. Using it as a diagnostics tool by itself, I think that requires further analysis.
So what's next for this kind of research? What are you going to be doing next?
So our research continues. We intend to, in the coming year or so, to collect additional data for Alzheimer's and for other neurological disorders, and to use some of these methods that we've developed in a clinical setting to actually track patients and see how we can develop applications that clinicians would find useful.
Visar Barisha with ASU, he's been working on research looking at how speech can potentially help diagnose or be an early warning system for Alzheimer's disease. Visar, thanks so much.
Thank you for the invite.
Be sure to be with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show. We'll check back in at the state capitol as the legislature looks to adjourn, may have done so by then. Also, our road trip up Central Avenue continues tomorrow. We'll look at the section between McDowell and Bethany Home Road. And a reminder, if you want to check out photos, hear the past stories, see a whole lot more, hear a whole lot more, you can do it all at kjzzcentral.tumblr.com. Good stuff to do around the valley tonight. Mary Chapin Carpenter will be performing this evening at the MIM. The Super Farm Market is this afternoon and evening at Superstition Farm in Mesa. And the Sci-Fi TV Dinner, Movie, and Discussion is this evening. That's at ASU in Tempe. The show was produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners, specialty meats, fine wines, and desserts for spring celebrations. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.